Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. In the next hour, we're talking about higher education. First up, we hear from UW Superior Faculty Union President Deborah Augsburger. She talks about emails obtained by the Wisconsin Teachers Federation at UWS that show leaders ignored shared governance in its plans to suspend 25 programs last fall. One of the things they show is that a UW system attorney recommended administration consult with faculty and staff on the decision, but that advice was disregarded. Augsburger spoke with me earlier this week about her reaction to the emails.
Surprise and great interest, I guess. It was just very interesting to find out the thinking and the conversation that was going on. We all knew that what had happened was wrong in terms of shared governance, just from the sheer fact that it happened. But we didn't know what went on behind the scenes, really. And the email gave a picture of things going on behind the scenes. The fact that University of Wisconsin system was not officially informed of what was happening, that they weren't told that the programs were being suspended until the day before the actual suspension. That was very interesting to find out. To find out that UW System Legal, which you can see from reading the emails, was saying, okay, you have the authority to overrule faculty governance. You don't need the approval of faculty governance to suspend these programs. But if you read these carefully, have you consulted with faculty governance? They reminded them on several occasions, they kept mentioning consulting with faculty governance, and that they had not done, And so it's very interesting that the day before they're asking for confirmation of their authority to overrule faculty governance, but they're still being reminded that they have to at least be consulting with faculty, and they went ahead and suspended them anyway. That was just very, very interesting to know.
Well, and as you're going through and reading these emails, which detail all the questions and the messaging and the preparation for explaining why they went about these program suspensions, the suspensions of 25 programs, majors and minors, including sociology, theater, and political science, as they're going through this and justifying it, why do you think that they went about it so as to avoid consulting with faculty?
I don't want to try to read their minds, so to speak, why they went about it to avoid consulting faculty. Well, I think that consulting with faculty would have slowed them down. I think that's one of it. I think they were hasty and impatient. They didn't want to have to go through the long process of having a long conversation and negotiate with all of this. I think they probably could have just had some kind of a meeting and gotten input from Faculty Senate and then overruled them, probably. But people would have caused a stink. They would have raised questions about this, this, and this. And so they went ahead. This is my guess. They went ahead and just did it because it was going to be easier for them. The irony, if you want to call it that, is that, of course, them doing it so suddenly without seeking input from faculty governance, without approval of faculty governance, just caused an uproar. I think people would have been upset about the elimination of the programs, the suspension of the programs in any case, even if they'd had a chance to give input on it and talk about it. But the fact that it was done without faculty governance just really, I think, made the reaction even stronger and more angry than it would have been otherwise.
Well, what about what they've said, what administration has said in the past, that they have consulted with faculty over the last 5 years and also went through the program prioritization process, and that throughout that time, they spell out in the emails or in the messaging within the emails, that they saw infighting between faculty and that they didn't want to see that on campus again.
I was around during program prioritization. I personally was not aware of infighting, so to speak. I think if anything, I've seen a lot of people being pitted against each other over the last while, partly because of the assistance and the attention to enrollments in particular majors, in particular classes, that this whole thing has been turned into a zero-sum game, the idea that there's a limited number of students and different departments are supposed to be fighting it out over these students, when in fact we just need more students, And this campus has been through how many directors of admissions and enrollment and things like that. You know, we've had a lot of turnover in the personnel that are supposed to be recruiting students to this campus and such. And I think some people have felt that a lot of blame is being put on independent departments and majors for not having enough numbers, when in fact there are lots of other reasons for this as well. And to put the whole focus on particular majors and minors isn't entirely fair. I mean, that said, people have to, you know, recruit students to their classes and things like that. But I don't think this has led to any less competition and bad feeling between departments, if anything, even more. You know, I didn't see program prioritization as being that way. And although program prioritization was certainly a pain, it wasn't enjoyable for anybody, I think, that was involved in it. At least that process was set up with the approval of governance. And it was itself seen as a legitimate process. And what happened now, you can't just take what then was a legitimate process and kind of magically extend it into the present and say, well, people have been thinking about this ever since, you know, program prioritization, and so this was all still ongoing. Obviously, concerns about enrollment and such were ongoing, but when program prioritization ended, we were told that that was that, you know. And there was this process that went on during the summer, guided pathways or such, but those groups weren't, I believe, chartered by faculty governance. They weren't official in any way. They took up the question of low-enrolling minors, but I don't think the issue of majors was discussed at all during the summer guided pathways process this last summer. So they've been, when administration says, well, we considered, you know, this whole process has been ongoing, this stuff was not official consultation.
The administration has said, and it's contained in the emails as well, mm-hmm. that they wanted to save faculty and staff from the tough decision of suspending these programs. What's your response to that?
I think you still have to go through shared governance. You know, I mean, I still think we have to have some kind of a say in whatever decisions were made. I mean, they have the power to make decisions, you know, since what happened in Wisconsin with taking away the power from shared governance that has happened. Sure, they have the power to do those things, but they're still supposed to talk to us in an official fashion. I think officially speaking, practically speaking, they did not consult with shared governance.
Well, and you said before, too, that you think that consulting with the faculty, that you feel that they felt that would have slowed them down as they made this decision. And in the emails, it's outlined as part of the justification for the suspension of these programs that now they're under a state mandate for student success. And there are a number of key program indicators that they're going to be evaluated on, and that even the institution's funding may be tied to that, which many may know as performance-based funding or outcomes-based funding. How do you think that's playing a role in what we're seeing, at least here on the UWS campus? Do you think there's any justification for them to move quickly on this decision if they felt like the financial health of the institution were at stake?
I think that's how they perceive it. I think that's quite possibly what they feel that they're doing, what they think that they're doing. There was a lot of question, the issue of whether the changes they're made are going to increase student success. I think there are a lot of questions about that. The research that they referenced on that had to do with sort of the whole guided pathways, the idea that students have to be encouraged and supported in making good decisions and good choices, that you need some kind of structuring of the environment to help people with that. But we have professional counselors now who are supposed to be helping them with that. I think other things they've said are much more indicative of what's going on, that it seems to be a lot about throwing resources towards different things, basically, to be able to put more work into, let's say, distance learning or to start new programs or do different things.
UW System President Ray Cross said last week when asked about not consulting with UW colleges as they were working on the restructuring plan, that discussing with faculty, in essence, delayed the process. And at a certain point, they were fearful that if they hadn't made a decision that they would have had to close 3 or 4 campuses. Do you feel like this is all tied to the difficult financial challenges that are facing the UW system and UW-Superior right now?
I think that has to play a part. I mean, obviously there's a larger context here where you don't have the support for the system, for the institutions that you should have, you know, and this is a problem at the Wisconsin level. I think the whole issue of ignoring shared governance or taking away power from faculty and staff to influence the future of their institutions, I mean, this is part of that, obviously. The legislature, you know, took away those rights a couple of years ago and such. So it's definitely happening within that context. And now that those rights, you know, have been taken away, there's a certain impatience, clearly, that you see that people are using to make those decisions. I do want to call attention to the fact, though, that, you know, when they made these decisions, our administration said that this wasn't about finances, that they weren't doing this because of financial exigency. They were doing it to improve student success, which is debatable, and I suppose to, as they say, be able to channel funds into new initiatives.
Well, and how does this all speak to trust between faculty and administration on campus? Do you feel like everything that's taken place since the program suspensions hurts the institution? I mean, do you feel there's distrust, and do you feel that's hurting the institution?
I think there's definitely distrust. I mean, we had a vote of no confidence. The faculty voted the majority, a very strong majority of people who were eligible to vote voted, and the majority of those, I think over 60%, voted no confidence. Yeah, I would say trust is very low right now.
So how does that impact working on issues that are important to the health of the institution, like enrollment or providing student services and all of these different factors?
You know, I think it has not been good for morale, I would say. I don't think it's been good for morale. I think people are, you know, making the best of the situation and doing their jobs. I mean, I still enjoy teaching my classes. If anything, I love teaching them more than ever. You know, we still have wonderful students. We still have wonderful, you know, coworkers and people who work here. I think a lot of good things are happening on campus. But obviously, there's a sense, a great sense of, I guess, distrust or maybe just disillusionment. I still feel in some ways that we were wronged in a way, you know, that the proper rules were not followed, that the kind of respect I think that faculty and staff feel that they deserve in having some sort of say in what's going on was ignored.
Are faculty willing to work with the administration to address challenges with enrollment, or do we see people digging their heels in and trying to protect their respective programs?
That's a great question. I mean, if you're asking me what should be versus what is, I mean, I think it's natural for people to try to protect their own programs, obviously. I think also people have to be willing to step up and consider the big questions. I would hope that faculty governance would be willing to do that and to take that on, especially now that we see what happens when people don't have a say.
What are you hoping happens now that all these emails are out there and people are aware of the thought process going into suspending these programs? Do you hope that UWS administration somehow decides to back off from this decision? Do you hope it will have some sort of impact?
I would be quite surprised and perhaps happy if they would back off from these decisions. I think given what's happened already, the vote of no confidence and other things, and the fact that when push comes to shove, they have the authority from system to overrule us. You know, if they'd wanted some kind of debate and discussion, you know, they would have had it. So I don't expect them to reverse their decisions based on things so far. I mean, my hopes are partly for UWS that going forward, I mean, perhaps people will, faculty, staff, students, the community, and others will feel emboldened or at least more supported and knowledgeable of what's been going on, how it happened, and maybe this can help shape or influence their demands. I mean, I still think there may be some ways in which administration might temper their decisions in some fashion or be more responsive to community, to community concerns and faculty and students and all the other stakeholders. I mean, I'm not optimistic about that, but I would hope that would be something to hope for. I think if people just, you know, I think it's good that people know what happened and the details of what happened, that they're reminded this happened all the way back in, you know, at the end of October and beginning of November, to be reminded of what happened, how it went down, and to know, you know, that rules were broken. And even though our rights under shared governance are nowhere near as strong as they were, that still there are things that are supposed to happen and are supposed to be followed. And I think this is useful for people not only here to know, but in the state of Wisconsin in general. I think our colleagues at other universities can see what happened here and maybe do some steps to avoid it. I mean, I think here, you know, the horse is out of the barn, as they say. I mean, the programs have been suspended. What happened has happened. But I think that going forward, I mean, I think there are people in Faculty Senate that are trying to work out a more explicit statement of what shared governance looks like at this point, what kind of power or at least consideration faculties, Senate, and academic staff Senate might have, what they might be allowed under this situation. They're trying to figure out what things should be and at least make things more explicit. So I'm not sure what that will amount to, but I think that's going on. And, you know, I would hope that this information coming out lets them know a little bit about how these decisions were made, and maybe it will be able to embolden them or strengthen them in asking or expecting better from administration in the future. I mean, I think that AFT Wisconsin, in general, and the other union members at other institutions, and maybe faculty senates at other institutions, can look at this and maybe learn from it or get some support for the things they're trying to accomplish.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me about this. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for asking.
Again, you were listening to Deborah Augsburger, UWS Faculty Union President. We reached out to UWS administration for interviews about the emails, but they were unavailable. A UWS spokeswoman said in an email that leaders met their obligations in suspending programs and have the support of UW System and the UW Board of Regents. Administration also said the university will continue to provide a robust offering of programs and that leaders did consult with faculty and staff to prioritize programs based on enrollment data. Chancellor Renee Wachter provided this statement in response to our request for an interview. I remain dedicated to the success of UW Superior and our students. Eliminating or suspending programs with low enrollment can be controversial, and these were certainly difficult decisions to make. Based upon continued input from faculty, we will focus on the programs that have thriving enrollment, making us stronger in the future while meeting the needs and demands of our undergraduates. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll hear from UW System President Ray Cross. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. In this hour, we're talking about higher education. Last week, UW System President Ray Cross spoke to Northern Wisconsin leaders during the 33rd Annual Superior Days lobbying event in Madison. He spoke about the challenges facing institutions, including UW Superior, and the role of universities in stimulating economic development across the state.
As you know, UW Superior's had some difficult financial issues over the last few years, and Renee, Chancellor Wachter's done an excellent job of trying to balance that budget. And I have to say a few things about some of their positive trends right now. Freshman applications are probably the second highest they've been in the last decade. Admittance, those individuals that are admitted, is at a 10-year high. Superior is the second largest by percentage enroller of, if I can use that word, of international students in the whole system, second only to Madison, which is pretty impressive. 96% of Superior's graduates are employed within 6 months. I want to put that in context because I think the future of Superior, UW-Superior, is really on the upswing. And they've had a few difficult years, and I really compliment you, Renee, for that. I want to talk a little bit about economic development and the role of the university in that and your role in that and what it means to Northwest communities. As Pat knows, I spent some time in Bemidji, Minnesota. And when you're up north and you feel isolated from the rest of the world, how do you find ways to stimulate the economy? What kind of tools can you do? And I want to compliment UW-Superior and Mayor Payne for their listening sessions and that the campaign they're working on, because one of the first things you have to do is partner with those around you and align what you're doing into a concerted effort. And I'm going to make some key points here in a minute, but I first want to cover some of the challenges you face. How do you grow businesses? How do you start businesses? How do you stimulate businesses in a rural, more small community atmosphere? How do you tell and explain to potential investors, this is a good place to put your money? Let me try to tick off a few challenges. Why is this important? Important for you, but it's also important for Wisconsin. Morna, my colleague and friend here, alluded to the demographic challenges. I'm going to make a statement here. I'm going to ask you to raise your hand if you believe me. There's some humor in that because, you didn't catch that, did you? There's some humor in that because most people don't believe demographic data. And yet it is one of the few fields of social science that's actually factual. It's ironic. So let me tick this off. In the next 30 years in this state, 30 years, the growth in the population of this state, of those people between 18 years old and 64 years old, generally considered the working age, is only going to grow by about 1% for 30 years. There's some people who are raising their hands. That's pretty good. But let me give you the counter of that. 95%+, because I didn't count those below 18, 95%+ of that growth is people my age and older. And you heard Morna say, she's raising her hand too. You heard Morna say that the portion of the population, the working population, is going to slip from 62 to about 55%. That complicates your problem enormously. It complicates the whole state's problems enormously. And I would argue that 95% of the people in the Capitol will raise their hand when I ask them if they believe that data, but they will not take action that reflects that they believe it. Follow me? We don't really believe that's going to happen. Something, some miracle is going to take place, and all of a sudden we're going to have workers all over the place. It's exacerbated in your case because there's also an out-migration from rural communities, smaller communities, to more major urban communities. It exacerbates the problem for much of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota, the upper Midwest is all facing that challenge. So what do you do? And everybody I know that's in economic development, and I've been on so many of these boards, Tim has probably attended a gazillion of them, Mark has too. Everybody I know struggles with these questions. So there was a book written a few years ago, Richard Florida, and he's written several books about the creative class. And those of you in the economic development arena all read his books, know all about it. His idea was you create an environment that is supportive and encourages basically young people, because that's where the creativity mostly resides. So how do you create this environment? And Syracuse had 40 and under clubs, all these different communities create this environment to help young people feel like they're encouraged. Well, Endicott, New York, just near Binghamton, boy, they spent a fortune trying to embrace Florida's idea. And they did all of these things to stimulate this economy and to create this attractive environment, which is diverse and vibrant for youth. It just didn't have sufficient critical mass, and it was an abject failure. What in the world? Florida's idea didn't work. In part because I think they lost the focus of what this is all about. How do you stimulate, encourage, reinforce creativity? I served on a design team at General Motors for a while as a consultant, and there were several rules that General Motors had for any idea development in their operation in the engineering department, design department. One is that you could never discard an idea until you had thoroughly explored it. And I'm going to make this statement about communities like those in the Northwest and elsewhere in this state. Our biggest challenge is to create an environment, an entrepreneurial environment, that listens to, rewards, encourages, and chases every idea as far as we can until we prove it's stupid. That's an entrepreneurial attitude. That's an entrepreneurial spirit that embraces that. And if we don't do that, we're going to look just like everybody else and continue to face this demographic challenge in a different way. At times like this, it's our attitude about ideas, regardless of who has them and what they mean to us. I have been on a number of economic development county boards and those kinds of things in other states, and I'm amazed. I keep getting frustrated over lenders. Banks are going to be very conservative. When you bring to them a pro forma business plan and you have an idea, they're going to be very conservative. Lending institutions, so we create these entities to help us find ways to encourage that. What they do is too often they get involved in the idea process too late. This collaboration that you're talking about and you're engaging people, and I'm going to get to the university in a minute, it's critically important that entrepreneurs or future entrepreneurs, people who essentially are the creative, innovative people, feel embraced and supported from day one. From day one. And whether it's the banker or the lending entity, boom, they come alongside right away. This is so tightly tied to the university that I can't explain it adequately. Universities can either be places that encourage the development of innovation and creativity in students or stifle it. We do both. Now, in some areas, that's exactly what we should be doing. But it's really important that the university becomes that element in your community that stimulates that kind of thinking around ideas and the pursuit of those ideas. And I could talk more about demographic trends, and I could go into this in part because our restructuring right now that we're experiencing, where we're consolidating, absorbing the two-year campuses into the four-year campuses, it's amazing. What we're attempting to do is find ways to maintain and provide access, opportunity, and affordability to students, because it is in these environments that we stimulate creativity and, oh, how do I do that? How do I tie this together? How do we link this? And it's a challenge for us because we want to maintain our structure. The inertia to keep us like we are is really powerful. It always is. It's a basic fundamental physics. I could speak about that ongoing for hours. But our goals was to keep the campuses open, because if we had to close two or three or four of these campuses, which we could have done given the financial condition, we would have decimated these communities. And these campuses, in many ways, as is true, the technical college campuses can be the hubs to stimulate this kind of activity if they work in partnership and are aligned with the needs of the communities. Extension, cooperative extension, is moving over to Madison. It was there years ago, as several of you know. Tim may have been around long enough to know that. I want to mention a couple of things with respect to this process of economic development. The listening part and the aligning part begins with an attitude of where ideas are treasured, almost held as precious. They're not disdained or criticized, at least not early on. And I, sitting at the dinner table, kids would say something, and I would say, oh, that's stupid. I still say that a lot, but you can't do that when you're trying to create an idea or an environment that is reinforcing an entrepreneurial attitude. Secondly, you need to take a design team mentality. And this idea of we're going to pursue everything until we're absolutely certain this is stupid. Thirdly, part of this is built on partnering and supporting each other and entities like SBDC, like Extension's work with business and entrepreneurship, Conrad activities, also our financial institutions and our lend. All of this is a partnership, and the university needs to be embedded in that. Leaders need to engage entrepreneurs with all of these partners early in the process, not too late. So you can adjust these ideas. How many of you have ever written a business plan? Quite a few. I have written several. Several of them were what I would call less than stellar. Some of them were outstanding and lenders were ready to invest right away. But assessing and evaluating the business plan requires time for you to think through alternatives. Too often that takes place sequentially rather than in parallel. and my fourth point is, and I'm taking a moment here because I want to say this, celebrate creativity. Platteville just held an innovation and entrepreneurs conference where they invite people to come over and present ideas in front of potential lenders. Banks love to do this, so you get banks or potential lenders. Hold a creativity conference. Hey, if you come here, we'll review your idea. We'll give you a chance to showcase it, particularly from people who live in the Northwest. Encourage, stimulate them to present their ideas. Host that and celebrate them. We celebrate athletes, we celebrate all kinds of arts. Let's celebrate entrepreneurs. An attitude of creativity and entrepreneurship can be irritating at times. I say that because my wife is a pianist. She can be irritating at times. Not just because she's a pianist, but because in many ways she's an artist. But that's what life is all about. The diversity of disciplines and the diversity of interests stimulates creativity and innovation. People come to Superior Days to inform Madison of the needs you have in the Northwest. The university for a long time, I think, has been perceived as the institution, the ivory tower, if you will, on the hill. We're going to come to you and give you solutions. Please help us reverse that. The university needs to be the entity that listens and engages you in your problems long before we work with you to solve them. Madison needs you more than you realize, more than you ever realize. Be engaged in that, be proud of it. Your voices had an impact last year. Last year was the best budget we've had in over a decade. Your influence on legislators made a difference. I would encourage you to continue to do that. So I've enjoyed working with you over the past 7 or 8 years, and I hope that goes on for a few more years. Yes, I'm getting old. If you didn't put those ears together, I'll help you with the math later on. But we all are. That's unfortunate. But perhaps now more than ever, the university can't be isolated from any of the issues people of Wisconsin face. We can't be the university on the hill. We have to be the university next door, your neighbor. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to share these moments with you.
Again, you were just listening to UW System President Ray Cross. Cross also spoke with WPR about confusion he sees over shared governance. You can find that story and our coverage of the UW restructuring plan online at WPR.org. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from Wisconsin Technical College System President Morna Foy. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we've been talking about higher education. Just before the break, we heard from UW System President Ray Cross. Wisconsin Technical College System President Morna Foy also spoke to Northern Wisconsin leaders at Superior Days in Madison last week. She spoke about how tech schools are working with businesses and students across the state.
We have 16 WITCs across the state. We offer over 400 programs and associate degrees, 1 and 2 year technical diplomas, short-term technical diplomas and certificates. And we're also the state's designated provider of adult basic education and apprenticeship classroom-related instruction. The content of all of our programming is employer-driven. So we use program advisory committees to connect local employers to our faculty and make sure that what we're teaching in the classroom is not only necessary in the workplace, but we're doing it in a way that reflects how you're operating today. This is true across all our program areas, whether it's agriculture, manufacturing, healthcare, IT, you name it. That's how we design our programs, and that's how we make decisions about how to deliver them. Let me just give you one example. So National Power and Communications Contractors Association, the PCCA, recently identified a shortage of skilled workers in the telecom and telepower industry, and across the country, but also right here in Wisconsin. Just so happens that a leader with Push Incorporated, Bud and Rice Lake, is a member of the PCCA board, and he's very familiar with WITC as well for providing skilled workers in broadband and IT and in the utility industry. So the result of that connection is that now, starting this fall, we will have a new 30-credit, one-year utility construction technology program at WITC. And they are expecting their first graduates next May to address that industry need. That's a pretty quick turnaround, actually, to get a program up and running. But it's this unique, long-standing program advisory structure that lets us do that. It involves employers at the ground floor of our programming decisions, and it helps us explain why it is that we have such great placement rates. Over 90% of our students are employed within 6 months of their graduation, most of them in the specific areas in which they study, and most of them actually in the areas where they went to school. When an employer helps to develop our curriculum and helps us to make decisions about how best to get that information to students, personally, they know what the skills are that our graduates have, and therefore they're much more likely to hire them. So what's our reach? You guys know WITC itself is one of our biggest geographic districts, but we actually educate over 300,000 Wisconsinites every year. Just to give you a little perspective, that means the equivalent essentially that our students could fill Lambeau Field four times. That would be a great football game, actually. Our student population is about half women, which might surprise some of you. And about 16% are students of color, which outpaces Wisconsin's population as a whole. The average age is 33, a little bit less for our associate degree students. And most of our students are working. In fact, many of them are working a full-time job and also taking a full-time load at college. So why do they come to a technical college? I would say in one word, it's opportunity. I want to frame my comments from here on out in terms of why and how an individual might access our colleges, especially WITC. So first, our colleges provide an early start. Last year alone, nearly 37,000 Wisconsin high school students earned over 140,000 college credits while they were still in high school. Dual credits count toward their high school graduation requirements, and they can be put on your transcript, and you can take them to either a technical college or another higher education institution of your choice. We estimate those credits last year saved Wisconsin families nearly $20 million in college tuition, and they were provided at no cost to the student or their family. WITC itself awarded about 5,300 dual credits last year to nearly 1,500 students. That's a pretty significant impact in your part of the state, with a value of about $700,000 in tuition remission. So what's the practical value of that besides that you get some credits on a transcript? Well, let me just give you one example. Unfortunately, weather this week forced us to cancel our annual student showcase that we do in the Capitol Rotunda, and that is a great event. We stole it from the university system, like many of our ideas, but no, never mind. What it does is we bring our students from all of our colleges, and they get to talk to legislators and policymakers about service learning projects they're doing, internships, their choice of academic program, what their future plans are. It's a great leadership building experience. But it's also a great opportunity for me to talk to students from across the state and find out how their technical college experience is affecting them. So last year, we had two students who were in WITC's Construction Essentials program. This is a dual enrollment program with area high schools. And they were at the showcase. Both of them said that based on that experience of being in that college level course, of having to do college level work and finding out that with the proper guidance and support that they could do it, plus it was incredibly exciting and fascinating for them. They were gonna continue now, their plans were to continue on after high school to WITC. Now, what makes that especially interesting is that they were making that choice instead of their previous plan. So prior to taking this dual enrollment class, their plan after high school was to major in ice fishing. And that is a direct quote. So I hope they are still ice fishing because that is a blast. But in addition to that, they are now also preparing themselves to be contributing members of the Northwest economy. And that's really exciting. WITC has a long-standing and very dynamic partnership with Superior High School. Most recently, they just developed an automotive academy to provide dual enrollment credits in that area. But some of the other areas that WITC offers Superior students are the certified nursing assistant track, which, by the way, is a mandatory requirement for any nursing program at our schools or at the UW system or at a private college. If you want to become an RN, you need to get your CNA along the way. So that's a great opportunity. Personal care worker, welding, machine tool, and industrial maintenance are just some of the other areas in which you can get dual enrollment in high school from WITC. Our colleges are also a first choice, and I am well aware that for many people there is still a desire and a goal to go to a four-year institution. And frankly, here in Wisconsin, with our university system, with our private colleges and universities, they have some great offerings and they are a great choice for many. But at the same time, technical colleges are no longer Wisconsin's best kept secret. I spent the first 15 years basically of my career with the system, hearing that over and over and again. I don't so much anymore. And I think it's a reflective of high placement rates, great return on in their investment as a student in terms of better compensation in their job or new opportunities to pursue different careers. Student satisfaction is very high. We've done a lot of work in transfer and lifelong learning that helps people see all their post-high school choices as really part of a lifelong education journey. From high school valedictorians to veterans who are trying to take their military experience into the civilian workforce, to somebody who's had a great career and wants to up it a notch or make a career change. Wisconsinites, I think, really do know the value of a technical college where our instructors have industry experience. There's hands-on learning that starts the minute you walk on campus, not a few years down the road, and where they have a great shot of getting through their college experience debt-free. For many of our colleges, though, we also offer another chance. I think we all are aware of the demographic challenges that Wisconsin is facing. We're getting older. Our working population is dropping from about 62% right now to about 55% of our total population in the state by 2040. And we really need to maximize our participation rate. We just can't afford to let any of our neighbors miss out on Wisconsin's economic growth. I think that's probably particularly true for the Superior area. So it's important to get everyone involved, but yet we all know that not everybody has had a very positive initial experience, I'll put it that way, with education. I think all of us may know somebody who either didn't do very well in high school or in fact didn't have a great experience and dropped out. We also know folks who don't feel prepared to take that next step to college or university, or they try it and it doesn't work out and they end up leaving again without a credential. Technical colleges use a comprehensive student support strategy, small class sizes, and stackable credentials to make sure that every student has a pathway to success. One of our students is a state ambassador from Western Technical College in La Crosse. I think she represents a lot of our classmates who talk about going back to technical college first to get her high school GED. Then she enrolled in an associate degree program in information technology. And prior to even graduating from that program, she had a full-time job lined up, basically doubling any employment opportunity in terms of compensation that she'd had prior, just 18 months prior. You may also know people for whom English is not their first language, or who have to overcome other barriers to career success. More than 14,000 individuals with disabilities succeeded at a technical college last year. And our colleges are also the state's primary provider of English language learners, for pairing it with a occupational skill program to get folks from this point to a career as quickly and efficiently as possible. Finally, I do need to talk about a group whose past decisions may mean a lifetime of struggle. Wisconsin's prison population is about 22,000 strong these days. The National Employment Law Project estimates that a little over 20% of our adult population has a criminal background here in this state. Access to job training and employer networks allow individuals who have those past experiences to make a positive contribution to our local communities. So we have a great track record of working with the state's prison and jail systems, but I just want you to know that WITC and all of the colleges have recommitted themselves to working on programs to serve both our incarcerated and our newly unincarcerated population, really just making sure that they get on a path that's going to be positive and that involves employment and contribution to our communities. Technical colleges are also a destination. More than 8,000 students transferred credit to a tech college last year from the UW system or from one of our private four-year universities. You know, people often think that we're the first stop on the educational path, but truthfully, I think students are in a different place now than they were certainly when I was going to college. For whatever reason, they are much more consumer-oriented when it comes to college. They will move around, they will go more than one place, and they go back again and again, I think in part because their careers are demanding it. There's a growing number of students who attend a technical college after earning a credential somewhere else. So they already have a college degree, either from a 2 or a 4 year. And they're coming back now to hone up on a skill or advance a skill to take their career to a new level. We also do a lot more transferring in the other direction. More than 6,000 students went from technical colleges into the UW system or one of the private colleges and universities here in this state last year. You know, that is really evidence of the fact that institutions in the UW system, Superior, WITC, and tech college institutions are working hard to make those transfer opportunities viable. We don't just throw students out into the world and say, good luck to you now. Go talk to them yourself. We set up the opportunities, we connect the dots for them, and I think that is making a big difference in terms of students' ability to move around. WITC itself has articulation agreements, so that's that formal agreement for transfer with UW Superior in a number of areas, including accounting, finance, business management, early childhood, human services, associate programs. We're also working hard together to maximize our universal transfer agreement so that students' gen ed courses are portable and that they don't end up having to duplicate both time and expense just because they make a career change or an education change. And, you know, because we have such great relationships with area employers, we also are a provider of customized training and education direct to employers in this state. This kind of incumbent worker training really, I think, can make a big difference in terms of connecting our faculty to your employers, and that's what helps us connect our students and our graduates to the workplace. Last year, WITC provided training or technical assistance to more than 3,700 individuals under these kinds of arrangements, under 256 different projects that they worked with in the Superior area. I'm going to just give you one example of that. Merck, I think some of you are familiar with, a transporter of coal in the Lake Superior region. They're also a major employer in Douglas County. They needed to figure out a way to reduce their costs. I mean, this is a constant need for employers. They also want to increase downtime, and they wanted to increase productivity of their workforce. So they worked with WITC, and they got a workforce advancement training grant to improve their workflow operations, to eliminate the need for outside contractors. So now Merck employees themselves have the skills to do troubleshooting on their own equipment. Then the result is they're able to pay more. They were able to provide advancement opportunities for folks that were already working there, and they increased their profitability. So the trifecta, bronze, gold, silver, all in one. They've had similar outcomes with a number of companies in the Superior area, and I just want to give you an example of the response or the evaluation of that kind of work by Superior area company. So the last three, we actually survey, we ask, after we do a project like that, how did it go for you? Good, bad, wouldn't do it again, would. So the last three employers that completed a project with WITC had this to say. WITC was very helpful and flexible, arranging classes and coming to our facility to train staff. So I hope you're hearing that, because they will do that for you. Second one, it was a very positive training experience for our entire team. And third, WITC has shown a willingness to go the extra mile and adapt the programs to industry needs instead of the cookie cutter approach to education. They will absolutely do that, and I hope that if you're an employer in the Superior area that you consider them as a education and staff development partner. We asked all our employers if they would recommend us to a colleague or a competitor. All three of these, their answer was definitely. So all of this work that we do happens in what I like to call the WTCS's culture of collaboration. And that would not be possible to do or to sustain if we did not have our state and local partners. Education, workforce development, economic development, government, including President Cross here at the table, and frankly, all of you. And that's why I'm actually here to ask for your help and support in two ways. Like all state entities, we are about to begin our biennial budget process. I know some of you who watch what happens in the Capitol are thinking, wait a minute, didn't they just do that? Yes, we did, or the legislature did, finally settle on a budget, but now they want us to start planning for the next time already. So we're about to do that, and we will actually have to make that request next September, along with all other state agencies, and I hope that when we do, you all will take a look at it and see how our request and support for these initiatives I've just talked about align with what you would like to get done in the Superior area, and we'll be able to support that request. And the second thing I'd like for you to consider is what I mentioned at the top of my speech, which is we are heading north. On Friday, April 13th, we are going to be at the WITC New Richmond campus. We're going to talk about the state's attainment rates, which is the proportion of our working adult population that has a high value post-secondary or post-high school credential. This is an event that's being hosted by the Technical College System, the UW System, and our WACU schools, and how that increased attainment can lead to economic success for our state. The higher the attainment rate, the higher the labor market participation, the better off we should be. Labor economists are now estimating that the future of Wisconsin's jobs are, we need about 60% will require some kind of post-secondary credential, and unfortunately right now Wisconsin's hovering around the 47% mark. So as post-secondary institutions, we have made a commitment to move that dial up to 60% in the next 9 years, and it's that initiative is called 60 Forward, and I am inviting you to Google it. You can do it on your phones right now, 60 Forward. It'll pop up with some more information about that effort and what we're doing as colleges and universities, but to have you attend and be a part of our conversation, because it's not just what we're doing, it's what parents are doing, it's what employers are doing, it's what students themselves are doing to take that challenge by the horns and take action. We really, frankly, all of our futures are going to depend on it.
Again, you were listening to Wisconsin Technical College System President Morna Foy. You can hear an extended version of her talk online at wpr.org/superior under Hear Me Out. Up next, we hear about the challenges facing one northern Wisconsin school district. Maple School officials are holding informational meetings about plans for a roughly $500,000 referendum. Olivia Shalaby reports the measure is to help support and maintain the current programs in the district.
The Maple School District is struggling to provide services as they've seen cuts to state aid and decreased enrollment. That's according to the Maple School Board President Kim Pearson. She says the district lost 140 students over the last decade, adding up to a loss of more than $1 million. Pearson says the $582,000 operating referendum is necessary to avoid further cuts.
I think it's almost $4 million in reductions in the past 10 years. We don't no longer have early retirement programs. Our employees are having to pay more for their health benefits. We've eliminated some staff positions that maybe had really small class sizes. We went from 2 bus routes in the morning to 1.
Maple School Superintendent Sarah Crony says parents support the referendum to avoid larger class sizes, but Crony says seniors in the community have mixed feedback about the measure. She says some want to provide support for students, while others fear paying more in property taxes.
One of the things that real estate owners will tell you is that people will ask how the schools are. Are they good schools? Do they have a good reputation? Because that will keep and hold their property values. However, you'll also have others say, but if the taxes are too high, then people don't want to buy because they can't afford the higher taxes.
Crony says a resident with a $100,000 home would see an annual increase of $68 on their tax bill. But with a growing aging population, she says many property owners on fixed income struggle to make ends meet with rising costs. Voters in the district will take up the referendum on the April 3rd election. Olivia Shelaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The next informational session will be held on Monday, March 5th at 3:30 in the afternoon, and another meeting will be held at 6 o'clock in the evening. Both will be at the Iron River Elementary School Library. That's it for our program. Coming up next week, we'll hear from Superior School District Administrator Janice Stevens and Ashland School Superintendent Keith Hiltz. The two experienced educators will be leaving their districts after this school year. We'll talk with them about what's changed for education over the years, upcoming challenges for schools, and security concerns in the wake of the Parkland school shooting. Also, if you missed our live broadcast this week of the special recognition program on Twin Ports Olympic athletes, you can find it online along with today's show at wpr.org/superior. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.